Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
Well, I am moving, so I'm not doing that great.
Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about the Iditarod that desperately needs to get moving. We are a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Before we get stuck here, how about a word from our sponsor?
Support for Iditapod comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaska's communities.
Well, Mondays, am I right? The Chase Pack is now the lead pack in the 2019 Iditarod, and Bethel's Pete Kaiser is in front. That's because Monday morning, the team of Girdwood musher Nicholas Petit, who's been leading for most of the race, they collapsed on the edge of Norton Bay, which is in a corner of Norton Sound, which is in a corner of the Bering Sea. All of that is on the coast of Alaska, and it allowed Kaiser to race past, and at least five others flew by Petit. Petit has been pretty much stopped since about 10 p.m. Sunday. I'm recording this here Monday afternoon, and it's just been hours and hours of waiting to see if they're going to get moving. It looks like he's tried a couple times, but the team is stopped as I'm recording this yet again. Petit had led out of Unalakleet by a couple hours on Sunday and was the first to Shaktulik about 8. The others chasing him ended up resting for a while longer there. And for Petit, the wheels, as they say, came off a little ways outside of Shaktulik. Watching a replay of the GPS tracker at Iditarod.com, Team Petit slowed way down before fully stopping. They had not arrived at a shelter cabin as planned, and Petit and the dogs had to camp out on the ice. That was definitely not according to plan. Petit had been approaching the place where, in last year's Iditarod, he lost the trail and lost the race after Olsom went by and won. The Iditarod Insider crew this year talked to Petit early Monday, and with permission from Iditarod.com, as we'll hear, a videographer asked Petit about all of that.
Kind of the point where last year, you know, things went wrong last year, right?
Right about here. Past year. Yeah. But yeah, something about right here, huh? Maybe that's something else that they, that's in there too, you know, a little residue from last year, what's up ahead. But they also, they know where the cabin is. I'm really surprised that they didn't just go for the cabin.
So
I don't know what the hell's exactly going on, but we'll see if these dog teams coming by wake them up at all. Because they don't want to, like, they're all fine, they all ate good, there's no orthopedic issue, it's just a head thing.
How are you doing?
Well, I am moving, so I'm not doing that great.
Petit sure pulled out some long runs prior to this unexpected stop on the sea ice. Based on what he's saying and how the team looked on the tracker, it appears the dogs quit on him out there. We're going to hear more from Petit about specifically what happened, but it should be noted that this is a common phenomenon in that area. According to the Iditarod's official trail description, the usually 50-mile leg from Shaktulik to Koyuk, some speculation that it's a little longer this year as the trail hugs the coast more, avoiding open water because there is no sea ice, all of that is very bleak, flat, and deadly monotonous. I'm quoting from Iditarod here. Dogs are put off by the white expanse and won't go or will try to turn back. Every year, teams stall here. Some drivers are able to get their teams going after a rest, and some can get their leaders to follow another team across. Some have to scratch. This is where a coast leader is invaluable, and those are leaders used to running in this environment and who aren't fazed by winds or wide open spaces. All of that is from the Iditarod. Back to Petit. He told the Iditarod Insider there where he was camped that there was some trouble between dogs and his team, and that's when they quit on him.
And I told him, I always communicate with them, and they know what we're up to. So I told him, we're going camping, you know. And then young dog started, you know, he went to poop or pee or something, and Joey was behind him and he's been kind of picking on him through the trip. And he got a hold of him at one point. Well, he jumped on him while he was on the ground. And I yelled at Joey. And everybody heard Daddy yelling, which doesn't happen. And then they wouldn't go anymore. Anywhere. So we camped here. And we'll see what happens. I really don't like any of that.
Different analysts, Sebastian Schnulle for Iditarod and Jake Berkowitz, who had written a story today for Anchorage Daily News, have pretty much said that this makes it impossible for Petit to win. There's kind of no way, unless something really crazy happens, crazier than this, that he is ever going to pull back into first place. And right now, we're just waiting to see if he's even going to be able to finish this race. All morning, it's been kind of like watching a fight and you see a boxer get knocked down and he's on the mat, the referee is counting to 10, and you're just waiting to see if this guy is going to get back up. Right now, Petit is not back up on his feet. The team is still stalled. They are still waiting to cross Norton Bay, and we don't know if he's going to scratch or what. The countdown is definitely on. This means four-time in a row Kuskokwim 300 winner Pete Kaiser could be closing in on his first Iditarod win, maybe. Kaiser was first to Koyuk Monday morning, checking in with 10 dogs at 8:54 a.m. KNOM's Davis Hovey, who's in Koyuk, says the sun had just come up on Norton Sound as a flock of white ptarmigan flew up into the light next to Kaiser's dogs. Later, the team was resting on straw after enduring what Kaiser described as a marker-to-marker trail.
Yeah, the first, 15, 20 miles out of Shaktulik was real nice, and then it was probably 30 to 40 mile an hour snow, blowing snow, drifting right in your face for most of the way over here. So slowed us down a lot.
As the front runner, Kaiser announced his plans to rest for several hours upon reaching Koyuk, but those plans could change depending on the teams behind him.
Now we're in the lead and got to try to stay in the lead. So we'll see when these next teams get in and figure out how long we're going to stay here.
Olsom, the defending champ, pulled in roughly 1 hour behind Kaiser despite having left Shaktulik only 15 minutes behind him. Olsom says he'll do his best to take the lead, but he would be happy for Kaiser if the Bethel Musher wins his first Iditarod.
Pete has a beautiful team, and I think I didn't leave very long after him from Shaq, and he was here, an hour or more ahead of me now, so he obviously traveling a lot faster, so we'll see. But he's a good guy to have in front.
Last year's Iditarod, Olsom made the push from Koyuk to White Mountain in one long run, but he says that isn't guaranteed this year. With a healthy-looking string of 10 dogs compared to Olsom's 9, and an extra hour of rest, it would seem that the race is now Kaiser's to lose. But let's not talk about losing just yet, because no matter who you want to win the race, if you're a fan of the Iditarod, you definitely want to see Nick Petit finish, one way or the other. That is yet to be seen. Just like Petit's longer-term reaction to this big setback, this notion of rebounding from defeat is captured, I think, very well in a documentary on Iditarod Musher and three-time-in-a-row runner-up Ali Zirkel. It's part of a series called Losers on Netflix, and it really explores how Ali has managed to keep her head in the game over all these years or to get it back in the game. Highly recommended and relevant to Nick's situation at the moment. Speaking of Ali Zirkel, she is one of three women we're seeing mushing in the top 10. The other two, of course, are Jesse Royer and Esther's Paige Drobny, who's really just breaking into the top 10 for the first time this year. There's plenty of race to be run, but if this holds up, we might see three female finishers in the top 10 of the Iditarod for the first time ever. Somebody asked about this in an email, and I'm pretty sure it would be the first time after looking through the entire race archives. There's been a lot of years with two women in the top 10, a lot of Zirkel and Royer finishes in the money, as they say. That goes back to 2012 and 2013 when it was Zirkel and then longtime Iditarod musher and fellow fan favorite Dee Dee Jonro. Both of them have finished as high as second. And the Iditarod got close to three top 10 women finishers in 2005 with Royer finishing 8th, Jonro in 10th, and Zirkel in 11th. Also in 1991, Susan Butcher in 3rd, Jonro in 10th, and Kate Persons in 11th. Butcher, maybe you've heard this already, she won the race 4 times and finished in the top 10 a whopping 15 times. Anyway, if 3 out of the top 10 to reach Nome are women, that'll be a new piece of trivia, but it matches right up with the high percentage of women in the Iditarod, the highest ever. 17 of the 52 that started the Iditarod this year are women, about one-third, so having a third of the top 10 kind of makes sense. Well, sticking with a couple of the women mushers, but kind of changing gears a little bit here, we know that along the Iditarod Trail, the mushers spend most of their time alone with their dogs. But there's a way that they occasionally get words of encouragement from completely outside the race, from strangers sometimes on the other side of the planet. It's called mushergrams.
It's like an old-fashioned telegram to a musher along the trail. They come into the checkpoints and they're there for the different mushers as they come in, and they're messages from people all over the world.
Nan Elliott is a volunteer with the race. Her job in Unalakleet is supposed to be helping with cooking, but the checkpoint, it's been so flooded with mushergrams that for much of Sunday morning, she was helping an 8-year-old boy sort paper messages that completely covered an air hockey table. She says they were coming in so fast that the volunteers didn't even know what they said.
There were way too many. We didn't read them. But as time goes on and we're waiting here, probably we will be reading so we can tell people.
The messages are short. Most of them are very simple. They say who sent it, where it came from, and small encouragements. Things like, you got this, or you're doing great. There were mushergrams for just about every single racer, but 2 in particular had so many sent their way that the piles had to be held together with clothespins.
So I can say, just by looking at this, that Blair Braverman, who is online and has an incredible fan base, the Ugly Dogs, she has a lot of messages. And the other clothespin is for Allison Lefka, and she is an alum of Sweetbriar College, which is one of those lovely little women's colleges in the South. And boy, she drummed up a lot of support amongst all the alums.
Braverman, a rookie, is a writer with a very loyal community of fans. We really appreciate them listening to the Iditapod this year. On Twitter, they're circulating a document coordinating different mushergrams. And not just for Braverman, next to every name is a short description of who they are and how many mushergrams have been sent their way. Okay, so that's mushergrams, and before we get to today's listener question, here's a different question that a few people have asked. What is the teacher on the trail? Maybe you've heard of this and you don't know what it is, or maybe you've seen a GPS tracker on the map for the teacher on the trail. Here's KNOM's Ben Matheson with Mr. What's your name again?
Hi, my name is Brian Hickox. I'm the 2019 Iditarod teacher on the trail. So really what I'll be doing is I'm traveling along the race route to various checkpoints. And on the Iditarod Education website, I'm posting observations, reflections, and a lot of lesson ideas that teachers and students can use in their classroom.
Can you tell me about the scale of, you know, how many classrooms or sort of what that educational aspect looks like across the country?
So thousands of teachers across the country and outside of the United States are using the Iditarod in their curriculum. And the Iditarod is something that captivates students and can be applied to all different subjects and grade levels. So the outreach that I've had has been tremendous. Not only have I been throughout the race and throughout the year posting curriculum and lessons that teachers can use, but I've been Skyping in with classrooms as well.
How does one become the teacher on the trail? It's got to be a competitive process, huh?
That's a great question. It's a long process, so the application itself is pretty lengthy. You have to apply months in advance, and you have to create binders full of different sections, letters of references, your mission statement, how you integrate the Iditarod into your classroom, things like that. And then when you're selected, there are 3 finalists selected in the country. So as a finalist, you come out essentially a year in advance to have the finalist process, and you have interviews and you put on a presentation at the Winter Educators Conference. And when you're selected, you come back out in the summer at the Musher sign up, and that's when you obtain the official role as the teacher on the trail.
Okay, now for a listener question that takes us back to the race and some more technical racy stuff, and back to Ben for the answer. First, the question, how much information do mushers get, or are they allowed to get, during the last great race?
Hey guys, Gus here from Central Wisconsin. I was wondering how much information regarding current race details these mushers get, such as weather details, trail conditions, details on if the other mushers are resting, running, taking their 24, etc. I would think this information would be real influential in helping a musher determine their race strategy. If they are getting this type of information, do all mushers get access to these same details to make it a level playing field?
Thanks for that, and here's Ben with the answer.
When they pull into a checkpoint, mushers will often ask checkers or checkpoint volunteers about things like who's come through, who's stayed, and what the weather looks like. Mushers will also take a good look at the sign-in sheet, which is sometimes legible, and people do get chatty sometimes. As for the actual stats, there are often printouts at checkpoints of the leaderboard, although they may be 10 hours old and sitting on a table full of half-eaten food. The race has strict rules about outside assistance, and although cell phones and even satellite phones are allowed, mushers face the risk of running up against that rule about outside assistance if they were to receive help. Many checkpoints have the GPS information projected up on a screen, but I'm yet to see a musher sit down and really look at it. During the race, enthusiasts will often dissect the leaderboard and GPS data down to a really minute detail, but as best as I can tell, mushers get a pretty good sense of what their competition is doing and then spend their efforts on the things that are within their control. Thanks for the great question.
Thanks, Ben, for taking the time to answer that. The only thing that I would add is that the allowance for cell phones or sat phones is actually pretty recent. In the 2015 Iditarod, in fact, Brent Sass, he was coming off a win in the Yukon Quest. He was in the village checkpoint of Tanana, and the Iditarod actually disqualified him from that year's race because he had an iPod Touch. And there's no indication that Brent was using that for communication, and certainly no evidence that he was getting any outside help. But at the time, the race rules were such that if you had a device that could connect to Wi-Fi, you might be getting communication. There's really no way for them to investigate that. So they DQ'd Brent in that year's race. They've since obviously changed that rule to allow communication, but still no outside assistance. It's just a little bit different in terms of how they enforce that rule. Anyway, we're still taking listener questions, though the end is coming soon, at least for the front runners. You can send those to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Definitely, we enjoy getting the audio clip, so if your smartphone has a voice memo app, you can record yourself asking the question. Again, send that in to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. We left off with one sort of unanswered question from Sunday. We heard that Pilot Rob, that's the guy that Ben and Zach are flying with, Pilot Rob had to land his Super Cub, not according to plan, but we didn't really hear the whole story. No interview with Pilot Rob on that, and I wouldn't expect one. He's a pilot, not a radio personality after all. But here's Ben and fellow trail reporter Zachariah Hughes with more from an audio file they sent simply titled Pilot Rob Lived.mp3.
Can I bother you for a second?
Of course.
I just want to do a follow-up from something we talked about yesterday.
Yep.
Did Pilot Rob make it?
Pilot Rob is within the facilities now. I don't know the full story.
What have you heard?
Pilot Rob spent the night in the wilderness while his plane drifted in from several inches of blowing snow. He was able to read about half of his book, despite being cut off from all civilization and contact.
Did Pilot Rob complain about it?
No.
Anything else to add about the Pilot Rob getting trapped from a whiteout saga?
Unfazed.
In fact, he was asked, was this the first time this has ever happened to you? While we were in the sauna, and Pilot Rob reacted.
Now, I mean, I've scared myself before.
All right, thanks, Ben.
Yes, I'm glad we can all laugh about this, and I hope Quince Mountain is laughing along still, too, as he heads down the trail on a snow machine. I think I saw on Twitter that he was leaving Takotna, and there are more stories from Zach and Ben posted as an extended bonus interview conversation here on the podcast. We'll also have posted later today, Monday, hopefully an interview with University of Alaska Fairbanks climatologist Brian Brettschneider. He checks in every other week on Alaska News Nightly. That's our nightly news show here on Alaska Public Media for a segment called Ask a Climatologist. He is that climatologist, also on twitter.com at twitter.com/climatologist49. That's numeral 49. That interview coming out here Monday, but for now, that's all the time that we have. We're going to regroup after all this wildness today. I think we need it. Nick Petit's team continues to stay stopped. More on any developments as we hear about them, if he gets moving, if he doesn't. More stories to come on alaskapublic.org and knom.org. For now, I'm your host, Casey Grove, and until next time, happy, maybe happier trails.
change out the old socks and underwear, and I brought way too much underwear, because you don't change it. Have you changed your underwear?
Yes, thanks for asking.
I'm only on my third pair of underwear, and we're a week into the race. That's, yeah, I'm not proud of that, but...